identical and faceless, apart from the utter blackness of their sensory pods. As she flew among them now, they reached for her with spider-like legs, firing bolts of plasma from their hand weapons to propel them forward. In that instant, she understood.
Paramount! Recall the fighters immediately! Get them away from the debris field! It's full of hexes!
She fired as she flew, destroying one hex with every pulse from her fighter's ion cannon. For every one she killed, however, three more appeared in her scopes.
They're only droids,
came back the reply from the Paramount.
What harm can they do against starfighters?
Put me through to Darth Kratos,
she snapped. Someone's head would roll for this.
Master, the Republic ships have been infected with hexes. That's why they're self-destructing and turning on one another. I don't know how the infection occurred, but the debris field is full of hexes. Our targeting priority should be them first, then the fleeing ships.
You want us to abandon a golden opportunity to rout the Republic in order to play target practice against a handful of machines?
Darth Kratos' reply was full of contempt.
Colonel Kalisha's orders stand.
Axe heard one of the bridge crew call out from the background.
Launches!
She looked at her telemetry and saw what the Paramount had detected. Four missiles were rising from the surface of Sabaoth. Full of hexes, she bet. Not conventional explosives. Plus, all of the infected Republic ships, still capable of controlled flight, were abandoning their chase of the others and coming around to ram the Imperials. The Colonel's imperious broadcast to the citizens of Sabaoth hadn't been ignored at all.
Move the fleet, she told her master. You'll be caught between them if you continue on that course.
The Paramount neither responded nor changed course. A wave of anti-missile fire was streaking out to intercept the ascending threats. She could only hope it would be enough. Around her, hexes swarmed and clutched at the Imperial fighters. Some had linked arms to form wide nets and webs across the sky. Any ship that strayed too close was bound up and crushed. Other hex groups formed whips capable of slinging individual hexes to incredible speeds. Axe herself missed two such wriggling projectiles by only small margins. Other pilots weren't so lucky.
Target the larger concentrations,
she advised those fighting around her.
Ignore the infected ships. If they blow, we'll only have more hexes on our hands.
She received no official acknowledgement of the orders, but they were obeyed. Squadrons, disrupted by the unusual and hostile nature of the debris field, reformed to strafe the densest concentrations of hexes they could find. Axe joined them, taking grim satisfaction every time her cannon blew such an agglomeration to pieces. Part of her mind paid attention to the wider battlefield. The missiles had performed a startling maneuver in mid-burn by breaking up into four smaller pieces, each capable of independent flight. Now numbering 16, they slid through the first wave of defensive fire. Six mini-missiles were taken out in the next wave, and five more in the third. That left five to hit the fleet unharmed. Axe winced as they struck. There were no explosions, as she had predicted. The Paramount was untouched, fortunately, but four of the larger support vessels were likely to turn if the hexes gained control. There might be only a couple of dozen in each mini-missile, but that could be enough, particularly if they infiltrated the ship's control systems. In retaliation, the Paramount launched a series of ground strikes against the origin of the missiles. Axe had expected this, too. Instead of saving the munitions for fending off the hexes they already had, they were potentially being wasted on the people who had sent them. Punishment could wait, in her opinion. Better to be alive and angry than dead. She turned her attention back to the fighters. The debris field was much clearer than it had been, with only a random scattering of individual hexes left. The infected Republic ships had come around and were accelerating headlong for the Imperial fleet, doing what she had feared they would do once the Second Fleet was identified. To the people of Sabaoth, to Lima Zandrit, the Empire was enemy number one. Everyone else had to wait their turn.
Target the drives,
she ordered the fighters.
Only the drives. We don't want to break them up, whatever you do. We have to avoid creating another debris field for the fleet to wander into.
How do we destroy them, then?
Asked one of the pilots.
We let gravity do it for us, she said. Once they can't maneuver, either the planet or the hull will drag them in.
They're not the orders I'm receiving from Colonel Kalish,
protested a squad leader.
I know that.
The Paramount was still worried that the approaching ships were intending merely to ram them.
I'm the only authority you need to worry about out here. The first pilot who punctures the hull on one of these ships will get a torpedo up their afterburner. Understood?
Understood. All right, you have your orders, people. Let's get to it.
The fighters peeled off to pursue their new objectives. Meanwhile, the first infected Imperial ship was beginning to behave erratically.
Master, I urge you again to move the Paramount to a safe distance.
Where reason had already failed, she attempted flattery.
Were the unthinkable to occur, we would be left without your leadership.
Perhaps that would be prudent.
Darth Kratos agreed. Max barely heard him. In the background, filling the bridge of the Paramount, a familiar voice was shrieking. She switched channels to the one Colonel Kalish had used to broadcast his message to the ground.
We do not recognize your authority!
For an instant, Axe thought that her mother was broadcasting to the Imperial ships. Then she realized, with something that might have been a twinge of disappointment, that the voice had the slightly wooden quality of a droid. Why a droid, and not Xandrit herself? While the fighters attacked the infected ships, and the Paramount slowly ascended out of danger, Axe considered the pros and cons of broadcasting a message herself. It might give her mother cause to hesitate before launching more hexes at the Imperial fleet. But what could she possibly say to this woman she hardly remembered, if she was alive at all? I am a Sith now? I have no family? That certainly wasn't going to help. The retaliatory strikes launched by the Paramount detonated on the surface of the world far below. What had already been a bright hotspot suddenly became a whole lot brighter, and Axe wondered if the question of her mother's survival was now completely moot. Two more missiles launched from a different hotspot entirely. Then the first of the infected Imperial ships exploded, spreading hexes all through the fleet. With the survival of her own kind now at stake, she forced herself to concentrate on what really mattered. Chapter 29. The Auriga Fire's tri-laser cannon emplacements were to port and starboard, just forward of its hyperdrives. They angled out slightly so they could cover every inch of the ship and were accessed by two tight tunnels that smelled of grease. Lorin had taken the port turret and eased herself into the cracked leather seat with easy familiarity. The prosthetic glove on her left hand was just sufficient to wrap around the cannon's hand grip, while her right hand handled the delicate movements required to target and fire. The cannon itself operated smoothly, swinging freely on its gimbals as though fresh out of the factory. It wasn't the first time she had noticed the mismatch between the Auriga Fire's appearance and its capabilities. Another concerned its compact tractor beam facility, recessed behind a hatch in the ship's broad belly. It was a wildly non-standard feature for a ship of this size. She was curious to know how often it came in handy in the pursuit of Jet's normal job, but didn't really think Jet would admit to anything. For the moment, the flash and pound of the cannons was all that concerned her. A quick depression of the trigger, and a web of wriggling hexes vanished in a ball of gases.
This is as easy as shooting stump lizards on Kifex,
she called to Shigar over the head-mounted comlink.
Watch that trio coming in from above,
was all he said. Lorin swung the tri-laser and blasted them into atoms.
Don't worry about the Grandmaster, she told him. We'll find her.
He had been subdued ever since the Corellia had detonated, shooting hexes with lethal speed and accuracy. Two-thirds of the cruiser's escape pods were now accounted for, but Master Satil wasn't in any of them. Shigar had tried broadcasting over all channels, but the electromagnetic spectrum was a mess. What wasn't jammed by the black hole, Imperials or panicked chatter was full of hexes screeching. It was all the new Republic commander could do to coordinate the larger ships into safely picking up the escape pods without picking up hexes by accident as well.
Dead ahead,
said Jet from the cockpit. An escape pod had collided with two hexes that were in the process of cutting through the pod's thin hull. The Auriga Fire swooped in to help.
One each, Hetchkey,
Lorin said, as the tractor beam wrenched invisibly at the hexagonal droids.
Favoritism is strongly frowned upon back here.
She wondered if the former security guard knew she was joking. One hex tumbled away to port for Shigar to shoot, while the other, after a protracted struggle, wriggled into Lorin sights. Then it was up to Ula to give the pod's panicked occupants coordinates for the rendezvous point.
"Stay in the channel we've cleared," he told them. "Don't take any shortcuts."
"It was horrible,"
babbled a young midshipman on the other end of the line.
"There were suddenly so many of them, and they moved so fast."
"You're safe now. Just stay in the channel and do what Captain Pippoliti says."
"Yes, yes, and thank you. Another few seconds, we'd have been holed for sure."
The pod fired up its retro rockets and headed off in the right direction. Lorin hoped its occupants would be okay now. Several had been rescued and then fallen afoul of the hexes again, through either bad luck or poor judgment. One had stopped to rescue another pod in distress, only to be overwhelmed by hexes hiding inside. The Auriga fire had been too far away to help, but the screams had carried. Captain Pippoliti, the angst in charge of the commoner, and by default what remained of the fleet, had a difficult job ahead of her, distributing the traumatized survivors through the remaining 8 ships at her disposal. Lorin didn't envy her that job at all, with long-range comms scrambled, and nothing larger than a light assault cruiser to fill the place of the Corellia. But at least the lesson had been learned. The hexes might not look like much individually, but they were tough, and in large numbers were to be taken very seriously indeed.
"There's another pod at the other side of the web ahead," said Jet. "Do you think you can get us through?"
Lorin peered through the scope. The web was one of the densest they'd seen so far, with hundreds of the hexes linked in a multi-limbed structure vaguely reminiscent of one individual hex, spinning slowly against the backdrop of the planet below. The limbs whipped and snapped, flinging hexes at far-off targets and scooping up replacements from the debris cloud around it. The pod Jet had spotted was drifting behind the main body, its retros damaged. The interior light flashed rapidly on and off, spelling out a call for help in Mon Calamari blink code.
"Easily," said Lorin,
knowing nothing would make Shigar happier than killing more hexes. Except, of course, finding the Grand Master.
"See those concentrations near the center?"
Shigar said.
"That's the best place to hit. Take them out and the structure will tear itself apart."
"Affirmative."
Lorin flexed reel and prosthetic hands around the cannon grips, ready for action.
"Launches!"
said Ula, as the ship roared forward. Lorin glanced at telemetry just long enough to take a quick snapshot of the wider battlefield. It was dominated by several overlapping debris fields in low orbit over Sabaddon, the largest centered on where the Corellia had broken apart. The safe segment of the Republic fleet and several dozen escape pods were now well clear of danger, regrouping near the planet's rocky moon. The Imperial fleet was in the process of splitting in two, as uninfected ships copied the Republic's tactic of retreat. 2 squadrons of Imperial fighters were disabling the engines of several vessels, so they couldn't spread their infection by ramming or detonating nearby. Lorin approved of the tactic. She might have suggested it herself had not the infected Republic ships seemed so intent on targeting the Empire. Republic fighters swarmed around the uninfected section of the fleet, keeping the hexes at bay. Defying gravity and distance, some actually managed to reach that far. If just one was carrying a nest, the infection could take root all over again. Her mind latched on to that thought, and for an instant she was back on Hutta, staring at the droid factory, and the Sith blade was flashing like a crimson lightning bolt past her eyes all over again. Her fingers fell with the comlink to the metal floor, and a scream of pain boiled in her throat. She blinked, and was back in the present. The scream remained. "Launches," Ula had said. She focused on that instead. 5 missiles were rising through the atmosphere of Sabaddon, launched separately in groups of 2 and 3. The first pairing was aimed at the Imperial forces. The others, she was relieved to see, were aimed nowhere near the Auriga fire or the rest of the Republic fleet. They appeared, in fact, to be aimed nowhere at all. The possible motives of Lima Zandrith and her followers fell from Lorin's mind as the Auriga fire came within range of the giant hex agglomeration. She did as Shigar had suggested, putting bolt after bolt into the nearest internal cluster. That had a satisfactory effect at first. The hex's combined mirror shield defense was soon overwhelmed, and the cluster began to look decidedly threadbare, like a crater-riddled moon on the verge of collapse. But then, once again, the hexes demonstrated their ability to adapt in the face of a threat. The cluster rearranged itself into a stubby tube, with one flat end pointing at the Auriga fire. Loryn fired at the tube as a matter of course, and the mirror shields flashed into life, catching the laser bolt and channeling it along the tube's center. The bolt ricocheted backward and forward, joining others she fired after it, until the whole tube began to glow. She took her remaining thumb off the trigger just as the tube released all the energy it contained in a single powerful pulse, aimed back at the Auriga fire. Even through the ship's unusually powerful shields, the impact was deafening. Loryn fell back into her seat with one arm covering her eyes. A split instant later, a second bolt struck the ship. This one created by Shigar's attempts to destroy the target. The Auriga fire went into a wild tumble, then righted itself with a jerk.
Fire! Cease fire! Jet was yelling.
All right, we get it.
Loryn adjusted her earpiece.
What are we supposed to do now? Pull faces at it until it goes away?
I don't know, he said. But we can't take another hit like that. Our shields are down to 40%.
Angle the shields forward, said Shigar. Set a course for the closest of those tube things. When I tell you to, put the sublights on full.
That's madness, said Ula.
No, I see where he's headed.
Jet brought the ship around to face the tube Loryn had fired into. Bright discharges still sparked from hex to hex, running in waves up and down the length of the tube.
He wants energy? Energy I'll happily give it.
The Auriga fire leapt forward as though to ram. The hexes fired ineffectually at the forward screens, and the agglomeration's arms curled in to embrace their attacker. Loryn's hands lay restlessly on the cannon controls as the tube grew rapidly larger ahead of her. This, she told herself, was one situation where firing would definitely make things worse. Instead, she was part of the bullet and the trigger at the same time. The Auriga fire reached the tube's open end. It was just wide enough for the ship to fit inside, a fact for which Loryn was completely grateful. The tri-laser blasters marked the ship's widest point. The moment it and its passengers were completely encapsulated, Shigar shouted, "Now!" and Jet switched the sublights to full. There followed a horrible moment when the ship strained to move forward, but all the force it produced was sucked up by the weave of tightly bound hexes surrounding it. Loryn could see the effect it had on them at horribly close quarters. The hexes writhed and shook and slowly began to glow. Metal limbs flared like magnesium burning in pure oxygen. Black sensory pods popped, and hexagonal bodies stretched. She couldn't hear anything, but she imagined the hexes screaming. Turning a laser bolt back onto its owner was one thing. Absorbing all the energy required to accelerate a starship was quite another. The Auriga fire burst out the other side, trailing a tail of bright blue. The hex tube shook and bulged as it tried to contain the energy it had absorbed. A ball as bright as a sun formed in its heart, and Loryn feared it might actually shoot out at them, destroying them instantly. But then the hex tube buckled, as the ball didn't so much explode as discharge throughout the entire agglomeration. Thousands of hexes burst apart in an instant, spraying the surrounding vacuum with exotic shrapnel.
"Yee-haw!"
yelled Loryn, then added more soberly,
"Let's never do that again!"
The beleaguered escape pod and its occupants found themselves unexpectedly out of danger. It was a simple matter now to snatch it up in the tractor beam and haul it to safety outside the debris field, where other ships could look after it. As the Auriga fire turned about to look for another harried pod, Shigar said,
"Wait! What is it?"
she asked, hearing a note of urgency in his voice.
"It's her. Master Satil is calling me."
"I'm not picking up any transmissions," Jet told him.
"She's not calling me that way."
Loryn held her breath, not wanting to distract him as he concentrated on whatever he was receiving through the Force.
"See that chunk of the Corellia over there, Jet? Head in that direction."
"Will do."
The Auriga fire accelerated for a relatively large piece of the destroyed cruiser. The twisted oval fragment was approximately 50 meters down its long axis and featured a gold finish down one side, revealing that it had once been part of the hull. It tumbled freely through the hexes and appeared to be the focus of a concentrated scavenging effort, leaching metal from one end. Lorin readied herself for the order to fire. When Master Satil's pod came into view, getting her safely and quickly clear would be the priority. Then,
"I don't see any pods,"
Ula said.
"Are you sure this is the right spot?"
It wasn't the first time the former envoy had expressed doubts about Shigar's abilities. Lorin wondered if he was part of the Axis in the Republic government that mistrusted the Jedi and their methods.
"I'm sure," said Shigar. "She's not in a pod. She must be in a pressurized compartment in that chunk."
"I can ready a docking ring," said Jeff, "if you can pinpoint her location."
"We won't have time," said Ula. "There are hexes all over that thing."
Shigar said,
"You have vac suits, don't you? I'll jump the gap."
"I'm coming with you," said Lorin.
"No,"
he said.
"I'll need you on the cannon, making sure no more come aboard. Drop me off, back away, then come get us when we're out. I'll take a spare suit for her."
"And if her compartment doesn't have an airlock?"
"Then I'll think of something else."
She heard him crawling up his access tunnel, back into the ship, and turned to look at him.
"Are you sure this is the right thing to do?"
she called at him along the tunnel, unable to hide the intense worry she felt. The wreckage was crawling with hexes. One slip, and neither he nor his master would come back.
"Positive,"
he said.
"She's the most important person in the galaxy. It's my duty to save her."
Then he was gone, leaving Lorin feeling slightly wounded by his words. On Hutta, he hadn't come to save her. If his deal with Tassa Barish had gone awry, she would have ended up Rancor food for certain. But for Master Satil, he swept in with lightsaber swinging, risking life and limb, and not even letting Lorin help. She wondered if he thought she might slow him down.
"Don't think like that," she told herself. "We're still partners, and this obviously isn't going to be over as quickly as we thought. Chances are we'll find plenty more opportunities to fight back to back."
She swung the cannon around and picked off a hex standing high on the back of the wreckage. That was one less he would have to worry about. The Auriga Fire's vac suits were simple models with no armor, inbuilt weapons, or maneuvering jets, and barely 50 minutes of air in their backpacks. Shigar guessed they were normally used for quick repairs outside the ship, where they could be tethered to the main life support. Shigar stripped out of the new clothes he had improvised from Ula's official wardrobe. Brown robe, black pants, and sand-colored top, the closest he could approximate to Jedi colors, then picked the cleanest suit from the rack and slipped it quickly over his unprotected limbs. Ideally, he would have worn a body glove, like Lorin's, but there wasn't time for such niceties. He would use biofeedback to regulate his body temperature. He fixed his lightsaber to a clip on the suit's right hip, where it would be accessible in an instant, and slung a spare suit over the crook of his left arm.
"Have taillock primed and ready,"
said Jet over the suit's intercom.
"Okay."
Shigar tested the seals one last time. The air tasted stale, but that was the least of his problems.
"Get in as close to the wreckage as you can."
His breathing sounded loud in his ears as the airlock's inner door opened and he stepped inside. As the airlock cycled, he took the opportunity to center himself. He knew what to expect. He'd faced the hexes before. His priority, however, was to find Master Satil and get her out as quickly as possible. There wasn't time to fight or take any unnecessary risks. That would only get both of them killed.
"Can you hear me, Master Satil?"
he asked over the suit comm, using a band thick with the static of distant stars. Military forces normally avoided that channel, making it perfect for short-range transmissions that needed to go untraced.
"Perfectly well,"
Master Satil responded, faintly but clearly.
"How's your air?"
"Running low, but not critical yet."
The outer door opened with a puff of fog, and Shigar kicked himself out onto the hull. For a moment, the sheer weirdness of his position struck him hard. He was standing practically naked on the hull of a smuggler ship, surrounded by killer droids and wrecked ships, with the galaxy's brilliant spiral to one side and the jets of a black hole to the other. He couldn't tell if what he felt was joy or terror. The twisted wreckage drew nearer. Lorin's cannon flashed, and a hex went tumbling. Using the tractor beam, Hetchke pulled another hex out of what had once been a window in the Corellia's hull. That created a clear spot. Shigar braced himself to jump.
"Here's as close as we can get," said Jet. "Don't miss."
With one explosive kick of his muscles, Shigar cleared the gap. For a moment, the sky turned about him. The planet came into view from behind the Auriga fire, blistered with magma domes. And then he hit the wreckage solidly, with arms outstretched to find the slightest grip. He stuck fast and paused to catch his breath. A hex, alerted to his arrival by the subtle shift in the wreckage's angular momentum, peered with black eyes out of a nearby hole. Its forelegs came out to point at him. Shigar reached for his lightsaber, but Hetchke was quicker. The hex swept up and away from him into empty space, where it was blown to atoms by Lorin.
"Thanks,"
he said.
"Pleasure,"
came Lorin's reply.
"Are you going to lie there all day while we do all the work?"
He was already moving, tugging himself lightly from handhold to handhold in the perfect free fall of open space.
"You are close,"
said Master Satil over the comm.
"I can sense you. There's a shattered access port ahead. Go in that way."
He obeyed without hesitation, keeping a sharp eye out for more hexes. When he was inside, there would be no rescue from Lorin and Hetchke. The wreckage appeared to have been part of the Corellia's forward command center, and had been occupied at the time of the disaster. Shigar squeezed past several bodies as he wound his way deep into the twisted structure. The path was tight, and occasionally dangerous, with sharp edges and spikes to negotiate. There was very little light.
"Come to the next intersection, and stop there for a moment,"
she told him.
"I have to tell you something."
The sound of movement came from ahead, through the bulkheads he touched, and Shigar slowed to a bare creep, every sense attuned to the slightest change. The intersection must have once been broad enough for a landspeeder, but was now barely large enough to admit a person, particularly one as tall as him. There was definitely something moving down the right-hand bend.
"What I must tell you is this,"
Master Satil said.
"Ever since we heard the droids, I've been wondering just how much of herself Lima Zandrit put into her creations. The answer is around that corner, Shigar. Can you see it yet?"
He edged around the corner to see what lay ahead of him. There were 9 motionless hexes clustered around a pressurized door, as though waiting for it to open.
"I'm behind that door,"
she said.
"And soon you will be too."
"How, Master?"
He couldn't conceive of a way to defeat 9 hexes at once, when just 2 had been more than a match for him on Hutta. There was barely enough room to slide by them, let alone fight.
"You told me that the droid factory contained a biological component,"
she said.
"It seemed reasonable to wonder if the hexes might also."
"There's a fluid inside them,"
he said, remembering what he had seen on Hutta.
"It looks like blood, but they're definitely droids. They're not cyborgs."
"Not in the usual sense. They are something else. But the fact that they are at least partly alive is the only reason I'm still here."
"You're influencing them?"
"As much as I can, which isn't very much. They only attack when either obstructed or threatened. I'm doing neither, so they're letting me be. They won't go away, but at least they're not being aggressive. I think I can hold them back while you come to the door."
Shigar swallowed.
"You want me to walk right through them?"
"It's the only way."
"And then what?"
"Then you open the door and let me out."
"I have a suit for you."
"I won't have the chance to put it on. There's no airlock. I'll keep a bubble of air around me using a force shield. That'll give me a couple of minutes. You'll have to move much faster than that, though. I won't be able to hold the hexes and the shield at the same time."
Shigar clenched his fists. It seemed impossible, but she was relying on him. No one else could help her.
"I'm on my way, Master."
He nudged himself around the corner and came into full view of the hexes. Despite his faith in Satil Shan's mental powers, he fully expected to be shot down at once. Instead, the hexes just looked at him with their black sensory pods and rearranged themselves slightly so they could watch both the door and him at the same time. Feeling like he was in some kind of surreal nightmare, Shigar pushed himself into the tangle of fat bodies and angular limbs, taking the utmost care not to touch anything. He didn't want a chance bump to wake them from their uncharacteristic complacency. He even breathed quietly, despite the perfect insulation of the vacuum around him. The intensity of the hex's gaze made him squirm inside. Finally, he was at the door. A red light warned of pressure on the far side. He keyed an override into the pad, and the light turned green. The door would open at his command now, expelling the air in an instant.
Are you ready, Master?
Yes.
He pushed the button. The gale tried to blow him away, but he was firmly braced against the opposite wall. The hexes flailed in surprise, suddenly released from Master Satil's calming influence and blinded by the frozen air coating their sensory pods. Shigar was partly blind, too. He could see only blurrily through the mist stuck to his visor, but he had the advantage of not having to see. His master's presence was like a beacon to him. He lunged into the tiny chamber and hit the switch to seal the door behind him. The hexes scrabbled to get in. It wouldn't be long before they cut their way through. He had maybe seconds to find another way out. Master Satil floated in a ball in the center of the room, her force shield shimmering around her. A milky luminescence maintained barely a fingerspan from her body. Shigar was struck by how small she looked. In his mind, she always seemed of gigantic stature, not just dominating the Jedi High Council, but influencing the course of the Republic as well. Now, though, she seemed tiny. A grating noise came from the door. The hexes were already cutting through. Master Satil had left her lightsaber floating beside her, outside the force shield. He took it in his left hand, reached for his own with his right, and activated them both simultaneously. Their greens were not quite identical, and by their combined light, odd shadows danced across the walls. The room was barely 3 meters cubed. Apart from the door, there were no other entrances. That didn't matter. Shigar could make his own. Raising both lightsabers, he stabbed into the wall at a point above his head, then spread both blades out in a circle before meeting at the level of his knees. A red-edged section of the wall fell free, and he kicked it into the space on the far side. Using telekinesis to gather up Master Satil, he propelled himself through the gap. It was another room, requiring another makeshift door. He moved quickly, with confident strokes. Behind him, the hexes were wriggling through widening rents in the door and wall. In a second, they would be upon him. A hallway this time. He swept Master Satil ahead of him and hurriedly took his bearings. He had come this way on the journey in. At the far end of the corridor, he could see the distant spiral of the galaxy. A fat-bodied hex crawled into view, blocking his path.
Get ready,
he called over his comlink.
I'll be coming out fast. Good,
said Loren.
It's getting a little tight out here, too.
Shigar didn't waste energy replying. Master Satil's shield was undoubtedly strong enough to deflect anything the hex could throw at them, so he kept her ahead of him. His job was simply to move both of them, fast. The force rushed through him. Ever since his earliest discovery of his powers, he had loved the thrill of speed. It had helped him win races before his removal from Khifu. It had helped him survive challenges at the Academy. Remembering that wild feeling of acceleration, he dug deep into himself and kicked off against the wall behind him. The corridor blurred. Master Satil preceded him like a cannonball, blowing the hex backward out of the wreckage and into space. For an instant, all was turning sky and scrabbling legs. Then, an invisible force wrenched the hex away, and he was swept upward into the waiting airlock of the Auriga Fire.
Got them, Hetchke?
Came Loren's voice over the comlink.
Safe and sound.
Several quick blasts from the tri-laser put the hex out of commission, and sent 4 others that had emerged after Shigar, scurrying for cover. He gripped the sides of the airlock as the ship accelerated away, spinning agilely through the limbs of an approaching agglomeration, with Loren's covering fire clearing a brightly lit path. Then the door was shut, and warm air rushed in. Shigar hadn't noticed how cold his fingers had become. He rubbed them quickly together, then righted Master Satil on the floor.
"We're out of danger now, Master."
The force shield shimmered and dissolved. Grandmaster Satil Shan unfolded to a sitting position and opened her eyes.
"Thank you, Shigar."
She stood and smoothed down her robes.
"I owe you my life."
Shigar bowed his head and returned her lightsaber.
"I did only what I must, Master."
Her right hand gripped his shoulder.
"That's all we ever do, Shigar, in times of war."
The inner door opened.
"You'd better get up here,"
said Jet over the ship's internal comm.
"Fast."
Shigar led his master through the cramped corridors of the ship to the elevated cockpit. Ula and Jet were at the controls, with Clunker standing to one side, as motionless as a statue. Hetchkey was elsewhere, filling the empty tri-laser spot, Shigar assumed, now that the need for the tractor had passed. Ula glanced at them as they entered, then stood up and bowed.
"Grandmaster,"
he said with a nervous expression on his face.
"I am relieved to see you again."
"Have we met?"
"I am Envoy V, on the staff of the Supreme Commander."
"Forget the introductions," said Jet. "We can have a tea party later. There's another ship on the scope."
"Imperial?"
asked Master Satil, leaning over Ula's chair.
"I don't think so."
Jet brought up a wide view of the space around Sabaddon.
"Just when I thought we were getting a handle on this mess."
The viewscreen showed the remaining Republic fleet at a much higher orbit than it had been before, well out of range of the Hexes. Infected ships were lancing out in wildly different directions, thanks to crippled drives or gravitational pull from either Sabaddon or the Black Hole. The Imperial fleet, reduced to 7 ships, including its bulk cruiser, was also ascending to higher ground. A quick glance at the projected orbits showed that they were likely to cross paths in a few hours, but that was something to worry about later.
"What's all this?"
asked Shigar, brushing his hand through a layer of fuzz surrounding the planet's equator.
"That's where the last 3 missiles broke up," said Ula. "And 2 more launched since. They weren't aimed at anything. I think Xandrix is laying down a defensive halo of Hexes to protect the planet."
"As well she might," said Master Satil. "Show me the latest arrival."
Jet's finger stabbed at a bright dot hovering near the planet's tiny satellite.
"It appeared a minute ago."
"From the same coordinates as everyone else?"
"No. It launched from a crater on the moon. I think it's been hidden there the whole time."
She nodded.
"I'd like to broadcast a message."
Jet gave her the comm.
"It's about time you showed yourself," she said. "I'd very much like to talk to you, Dow Striver."
"And I you, Grandmaster,"
came the immediate reply.
"It pleases me that you survived this unflattering rout."
"Can one take pleasure from the survival of one's enemy?"
she asked the Mandalorian.
"One can indeed,"
he said.
"I will explain in due course."
"I very much hope so."
"Meet me at the moon in half an hour. Send one ship, no escort. You have my word that you and your party will not be harmed."
Striver clicked off.
"I don't trust him,"
Shigar said.
"We have no choice," she said. "Plot the course, Captain Nebula. Take us by the commoner. I need to speak to Captain Pippoliti now, in case we don't get another chance."
"We?" asked Jet.
"This mission has already lost 7 vessels of war. I will not risk another."
"Doesn't anyone care what I'm prepared to risk?"
"Look at this," said Ula,
drawing everyone's attention back to the viewscreen.
"The Imperials are launching a shuttle."
"We can't let it reach the jump coordinates," said Shigar. "If they're sending for reinforcements..."
"I don't think that's where they're headed," Satil said. "One ship, no escort," she quoted.
"And Striver did say we wouldn't be harmed by him," added Jet. "Are you certain you want to do this?"
"Forget the flyby of the commoner," she told him. "Get us moving now. I'll talk with Captain Pippoliti on the way."
"Yes, ma'am,"
said Jet, casting Master Satil a sardonic salute.
"We might as well run to our doom as walk."
Chapter 30 Ulla watched with mounting dread as the rendezvous point loomed. He was in the worst position imaginable, unable to act against the Republic's wishes because Satil Shan would immediately overrule him, and unable to reveal his identity to his real masters without blowing his cover. For a wild moment, he considered throwing himself on the mercy of the Mandalorians, but sanity fortunately prevailed. Striver had no mercy. The best Ulla could have hoped for in his care was slavery. At least he was alive, he told himself, and had a chance of staying that way if he stepped through this minefield with utmost care. The Auriga Fire's blunt nose was angling ahead of the Imperial shuttle on its approach to Sabaddon's solitary satellite. The moon was blocky and misshapen, more like a brick than a sphere, with a cornucopia of craters and fathomless fissures marring its ugly face. No wonder Striver had stayed hidden for so long. It didn't appear to have been mined or booby-trapped, which was a major omission for a colonial administration so keen to remain undisturbed. Ulla wondered if they'd simply never thought of it, or if they'd erroneously, but not unreasonably, assumed they would never be discovered so far from the galactic disk. The First Blood, Striver's scout, anchored itself to the surface of the moon as the two ships approached. It was shaped like a crescent moon, with forward-pointing wings that bristled with weapons and a matte black non-reflective skin. There were no markings of any kind, just two glowing circles on either side indicating ready airlocks. Jet prepared a docking ring and tube to cross the distance, and jockeyed to approach the starboard airlock. The Imperial pilot noted his intentions and moved to dock on the opposite side. Along with Lorin and Hetchke, Ulla watched the shuttle closely for any signs of treachery. The way the Imperials had illegally destroyed the Republic shuttle on Hutta was still painful to him. He expected better.
"Who's going in?"
asked Lorin over the internal comm.
"Sigar and I," said Master Satil. "And Envoy V.E."
Ulla swallowed.
"I fear I can be of little use," he started to say, but was cut off by Lorin.
"You'll need a bodyguard,"
she said.
"Just for appearances."
"All right."
"And take Clunker, too," said Jet. "I'll watch through his eyes."
"Can you and Hetchke pilot the ship on your own if you have to?"
"In a pinch," said the smuggler. "With the right incentive, I could fly a battlecruiser on my own."
"Very well, then. Maintain the umbilical seal, but close the ship once we have disembarked. Leave on my signal, whether we're aboard or not."
"Don't worry about that," the smuggler told her. "I'll dust off if you so much as twitch funny."
Ulla sought distraction in telemetry as the ship settled lightly on the low-gravity moon. Sabaddon hadn't launched any missiles since the last round. The main hotspot had been made considerably hotter by retaliatory fire, and activity was growing in other regions as well. It looked to him as though the occupants of the planet were regrouping in order to fight back, but it was hard to tell from such a distance. Every spy drone launched by the Republic fleet had been intercepted by the orbital halo of Hexes and destroyed. Maybe, he told himself, he could slip a message of some kind to his opposite number in the Imperial Party. That was a small and unlikely hope to cling to. With a series of clanks and thumps, the ship's belly grapnels took a firm grip on the dusty soil outside. The whine of repulsor lifts faded away. Jet took his hands off the controls and leaned back into the seat. For all his bluster, he looked exhausted, or at least hung over. His prematurely gray hair stood up on one side, and his eyes were heavily bagged.
"I'll mind the farm until you get back," he told them. "Don't do anything I wouldn't do."
Ulla stood, hoping against hope that the Grand Master would change her mind. No such good fortune. She was already heading down the cockpit ladder, trailing Sigar like a pet. Ulla waved Clunker ahead of him.
"Good luck," Jet told him.
"You didn't say that to the others."
"I figure they don't need it."
"Thanks for the vote of confidence,"
Jet grinned.
"You'll be okay. Just remember, you've got an unbeatable advantage."
"What's that?"
"The ability to see both sides at once."
Ulla didn't know what to say to that, or to the many other hints Jet had dropped indicating that he knew what Ulla was. Ulla had never had the courage to ask outright, not even during the long hours when he and the smuggler had sat waiting for Shigar to make good on his psychometric promise. Whether it was true or not that Jet had guessed, Ulu would rather it was never said aloud. His life relied on pretense. Once it was gone, he didn't know what that would leave him. So he just nodded and headed down the stairs to meet the others at the airlock, wondering how anyone in his position could be considered advantaged. He felt like he was being pulled in a dozen directions. If he wasn't careful, one sharp tug might tear him to pieces. Axe walked the short distance along the umbilical with measured fury. She burned to be back in the interceptor rather than wasting her time with Mandalorians and envoys again. It was as bad as being back on Hutta, only this time she had no clear advantage to hope for. All she could think of was the work she should have been doing at that moment, protecting the fleet from Hexes at least, or maybe even preparing an attack force to wipe Striver from the sky. She didn't like coming to him when called, like some kind of menial.
"You will speak to the meddling Mandalorian on my behalf," her master had told her.
"But Master..."
"Do I need to explain to you again what your duty is? It is to serve the Emperor through me, his instrument. When you defy me, you defy him."
And that was the problem, of course. She had defied him, by ignoring his orders during the Hex's attack on Hutta. Now she was being punished for it, while he waited comfortably half-frozen in the secret room in his shuttle. Whether her defiance had served the fleet or not was irrelevant. She could only forget all about doing anything constructive, let alone to the betterment of the Empire, until Darth Kratos changed his mind.
"I'm here,"
she said when she reached the First Blood's external airlock. Her right hand fiddled with the hilt of her lightsaber.
"Don't keep me waiting, Striver."
The door hissed open. A token escort followed her into the ship, three soldiers in formal black and grays. She didn't look behind her to make sure they were keeping up. As a deliberate act of defiance aimed at both Striver and her master, she hadn't changed out of her combat uniform. It stank of oil and smoke and combat, exactly like Striver's ship. Her hair swayed heavily down her back, like thick rope. The First Blood had a low profile head-on, but was surprisingly spacious inside. Its walls were ribbed rather than sealed with flat panels. Sometimes there were no gaps at all delineating corridor from hold. Wiring and components were occasionally exposed, all, she supposed, in an effort to keep weight down. She also assumed that anything secret was kept well out of sight, so she didn't trouble herself with memorizing what she saw. She just walked, following the sound of voices leading to the center of the vessel.
"Understand why you need all of us at once. Can't you tell us now?"
Axe knew that voice. She had heard it on Hutta. It belonged to a near-human who had fought on the Republic side, although clearly not a trooper herself. What was she doing here?
"I don't like repeating myself,"
said another familiar voice, the deep vocoder-inflected tones of Dow Striver. Axe walked around a thick pillar of cables, acting as conduit and support, and found herself in the main cabin. It was a circular room with glowing white floor and ceiling, and a central holoprojector. Striver stood to Axe's left, helmet just clearing the relatively high ceiling. To his left were a motley group of people, including several more individuals Axe recognized. The Republic envoy, a droid she had seen hanging around Tassa Barisha's security airlock, and the Jedi Padawan. Next to him stood a woman she hadn't met before, but instantly recognized. Axe stopped on entering the room, a wary hiss unconsciously escaping from between her teeth. The air was thick with the enemy's self-righteousness, concentrated mainly around the slight woman with the gray streak wearing the robes of a Jedi Knight. No mere Jedi Knight, she. The Grand Master of the High Council herself. Darth Kratos would grind his crystalline teeth in frustration at missing such a close encounter with the Emperor's most hated foe. To slay her would bring Axe considerable fame and fortune among those favored by the Dark Council. Axe forced her hand to leave her hilt alone. For all her ambition, Axe knew that she could not single-handedly beat both Master and Padawan.
she would have to strike with words instead of her blade.
The Jedi Order must be weak indeed, she said, for the Grand Master and a youngling to jump on a Mandalorian's whim.
The Padawan, Shigar, stiffened at her description of him as a child.
Not so weak, he said, that I didn't save your life at least once on Hutta. You are mistaken, she said, feeling heat rise up her neck. Am I? I'll try harder not to be next time.
Enough, said the Grandmaster, and the Padawan obeyed her instantly. We're all here now, Striver. Get on with it.
I do not take your orders, Grandmaster, said the Mandalorian. Nonetheless, you have a point. I brought you here to show you something.
The holoprojector between them flickered into life. Axe recognized the globe of Sabaddon, with its tiny gem-like lake scattered among irregular continent-sized bulges of heat. Magma seams glowed orange, forming a tracery that on other worlds might have been rivers. Several blue circles at the intersections of such traceries indicated settlements or industrial centers. Axe recognized the one Darth Kratos had bombed when the Paramount was attacked, and many others. Some that she remembered weren't visible at all.
This is how Sabaddon looked when I arrived 6 hours before you. This is how it looked when you arrived.
There was a clear difference. Many of the missing hotspots were now present. The brightest were brighter still.
This is how it looks now.
Axe didn't need to study what she already knew.
Your points? They work fast, said the Padawan. That's what Jet said when we arrived. He thought the colony was about 20 years old. It can't be more than 15, said Axe,
remembering how long it had been since Lima Zandret defected.
It's actually much less than that,
Striver said, resting his giant gloved hands on the edge of the holoprojector and leaning over the image.
Study this sequence of images carefully, and you'll see that the colony expanded 5% since I arrived. If you project that rate of growth backward in time, that gives a founding date of about 3 weeks ago.
Impossible, she said. That's around when the Sinzi was intercepted, said Ula. So what? It's still impossible.
Is it? Lima Zandra chose this colony partly because of its wealth of resources. With an army of willing workers and a means of making new ones, why couldn't she do whatever else she wanted?
If the colony could grow so quickly, why is it still so small?
That's a good question, Eldon Axe. You should know your mother better than anyone else here. What do you think?
Instead of blushing, Axe felt her face grow cold and taut.
Start talking sense, man, or I'm leaving.
Both of Striver's index fingers tapped heavily, just once, and for the first time, Axe noted that he had only 4 fingers on each hand.
Not exactly a man, then, she thought. But who cares about that?
I've been watching all of you, while you blunder about getting yourselves killed. That's the advantage of being first on the field of battle. Instead of testing Sabaddon's defenses myself, I sat back and watched you do it. It has been an interesting experiment, one that confirmed my previous observations. The inhabitants of Sabaddon are unwilling even to talk about opening their borders to outsiders, particularly the Empire, and they are capable of defending themselves when pushed.
We were taken by surprise, said Axe. That won't happen next time.
If you wait too long, surprise won't be the only thing you have to worry about.
What do you mean? Asked Satil Shan.
How long will it take you to call for reinforcements? You can't call, so it's a 2-way trip to send a messenger. Then a fleet has to be assembled. The larger the fleet, the more time you'll need. And with each hour, Sabaddon is converting more of its precious metals to machines of war. More than 30 ships field today. How long until 50 ships isn't enough? 100? 1,000?
Axe sneered.
No single planet could withstand the might of the Imperial War Machine.
I might agree, if the Imperial War Machine was available, but it's currently stretched across all the galaxy, thin and vulnerable. And the same can be said for the Republics. Furthermore, We all know that neither would come if we called. They would think your concerns exaggerated. They are more interested in fighting each other than this single, isolated threat.
Is it a threat? Asked Shigar. Sandrit won't talk to us, but at least she stopped firing now we've moved away. Why don't we give her what she wants and leave her alone?
Do you really think that's possible now? Said the female near human.
Why not?
Shigar looked at his master for support, but she wasn't giving it to him.
You are naive, said Axe. This world is too valuable. The Emperor will have it, or no one will.
And your mother must be made an example of. Otherwise, the power of this Sith will be eroded.
Stop calling her my mother! Lima Zandrit is a criminal and a fugitive. There is no possibility that she will escape justice.
Would you strike her down yourself if you could?
I would, and I will. She means nothing to me.
Good. I believed once that I might reason with her. I believed that I could broker an agreement that would keep her and her creations in check. Now I fear that it is too late for any kind of negotiation. No reasoning or agreement is possible.
Has she gone mad?
Asked the trooper to Shigar's right.
If so, there are other options. We could take her out and talk to someone else, for instance.
This plan suffers from one small but fatal flaw.
That is?
Asked the Republic envoy.
Lima Zandrit is already dead. She has been for some time.
An icy splinter snapped in Axe's heart at those words, leaving her unable to tell if she felt triumph or grief, or both.
I think it's time you told us everything you know, said Master Satil.
I agree, said Lorin. Since when do Mandalorians negotiate with anyone?
Ula remembered Jet telling him. They don't believe they have any equals.
You were the person Zandrit's emissaries were hoping to meet, Ula said. You came looking for them when they didn't show up.
The giant domed helmet inclined in his direction.
Correct.
Was Zandrit herself supposed to be aboard the Cinzia?
Asked Shigar.
Is that why you think she's dead?
No. She sent another. I believe she was here when she died.
So you don't know for sure?
Asked the Sith. Her face had a white, pinched look under her blood-red dreadlocks.
I am certain of it.
Did you kill her? Did you see her body?
No.
So how can you be certain?
Stryver tapped his helmet with one gloved finger. Ula couldn't see the Mandalorian's face, but was positive he was smiling.
She means nothing to me,
the young Sith said firmly, as though reassuring herself of the truth of it.
I just want to be certain.
Be certain of this, Eldon Axe. When those droids your mother created leave this world, they will consume the entire galaxy in less than a generation.
Ula blinked. The claim was preposterous, but if Stryver truly believed it, that did explain another puzzling piece of the story.
So that's why you were willing to talk to her,
Ula said.
Lima Zandrit was a threat or a possible ally, just like the Empire.
A force to be reckoned with, potentially, said Master Satil. A force we clearly underestimated, but you wouldn't have taken her word on it. You must have received some kind of proof.
A demonstration factory. In 2 days, it manufactured 17 droids and 2 duplicates of itself, using nothing but the materials around it. The duplicate factories went immediately to work, making another 4 factories and even more droids. Their rate of reproduction was limited only by the energy available to them. Later we discovered how they send out routes to tap into the local supply, ensuring they never run out. Curious, we put the droids in the pit, and they prevailed against all but the current champion. Then the droids and factory self-destructed, leaving insufficient remains for us to probe the secrets of their manufacture or function. The message was clear. The Mandalore sent me to pursue the conversation.
Why did he send just you? Asked Lorin. You're not much use to us on your own.
I can confirm several hypotheses that you might already be forming. This will save you time so you can begin to act.
Stryver raised his right hand and began ticking off points.
One.